It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a Wisconsin author shares his experience of childhood sexual abuse and how he hopes to support others as they move from victim to survivor.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
Republican lawmakers are advocating to install an inspector general for each of 16 state agencies, including WEDIC and the DNR. We'll find out why.
And from the continuing story of the Lincoln Hills Youth Correctional Facility, we learned this week that prison misconduct allegations have risen dramatically in the last few years.
For the latest on those stories and more, Robert Menser joins us now. He's the storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. Robert, welcome back.
Hey.
Well, so early on this week, we learned that some Republican lawmakers were looking for support on a bill that would name an inspector general for each of 16 agencies. How would that legislation work, for starters?
Yeah, so this inspector general would work for the legislature. They would oversee a bunch of agencies. So it's the Department of Corrections, the Department of Natural Resources, Department of Transportation, also the UW system. And the goal of having them would be to root out waste, fraud, and abuse in state agencies. The old chestnut that you hear, right? You would almost think that it's one word if you're listening to politics, right? It's waste, fraud, and abuse. And so the idea is that if there are some agencies, like the Department of Health Services currently has an inspector general, and some do, but this would be, a watchdog that this is being proposed by a couple of conservative Republicans, and I think that it's the hope is that it would keep costs down and keep sort of budgets honest within these departments.
And they were looking for bipartisan support for this to make it veto-proof. Are they getting anywhere with that?
So the Democrats who were quoted, WisPolitics.com wrote about this, and the Democrats that they interviewed were sort of, I would characterize as sort of lukewarm on it, and they said that they wanted some changes, but they weren't against it. The reason that they want this to be veto-proof, of course, is because it would represent sort of the legislature taking some executive authority away from Governor Walker, because these departments are in the executive branch for the most part. And so there's a thought that the governor might see that as usurping some authority and want to veto that. So that's why they think they need Democrats.
And the concern, one concern among some Democrats who weren't so sanguine about it is the question, who gets to appoint these inspectors general?
Yeah, and Republicans is the answer. As proposed now, they would be appointed by Republicans, and they would serve 6-year terms. So these would be nonpartisan positions, and there's inspector generals. Like I said, there's inspector generals in state government now, and certainly in federal government, and they can operate in a nonpartisan fashion. But I think Democrats have some concerns, and express some concerns that they might end up being sort of like going on a partisan crusade. Also, we're saying this bill that's being circulated now is kind of an update on an earlier bill. The same Representative Dave Craig had a bill that would have had this new agency replace the Legislative Audit Bureau, which is used for some of the same functions to run numbers and get estimates of budget questions for the legislature. And according to Craig in this report, absolutely no one was supported that idea. So this is sort of an update on that, and he indicates that maybe they'll make more changes as they try to get Democratic support.
And given the power issue that you talked about, whether if this thing passed, some power would be taken away from Governor Walker, has he given any indication about his temperature on this one?
So not formally, but I think the fact that that the sponsors of the bill are already saying that they are seeking Democratic support and wanting to make this veto-proof is probably a pretty good indication that they have a sense of where the governor might come down.
We're going to move on now and look at a Gannett Media report released this week on prison misconduct allegations in recent years. And what is the story there?
So Keegan Kyle of Gannett, Wisconsin's investigative team took a look at these claims of misconduct. This is throughout the prison system, and found that they have risen. So he requested this data, and the Department of Corrections did a special look at instances of reports that flag misconduct. They found that in 2012 there were about 1,200 of these reports. This involves inmates as well as guards, I should say. In 2013, that was up to over 1,400. In 2015, 1,500. In 2013, 1,400. 2015, 14. I'm getting confused. 2014, 1,500, and this year it looks like it's on track to exceed that 1,500 total. So that's a concern. It connects with earlier reporting that Keegan Kyle has done about overtime being way up within the prison system, and that found over 1.3 million hours of overtime in the last fiscal year, and a big rise. And this is what some people say, some people within the system argue, contributes to problems like we have seen at Lincoln Hills, the juvenile detention facility, as well as just making for a more dangerous job and a worse environment within the state's corrections facility.
Now, you mentioned Lincoln Hills youth correctional facility, and there was some news about how much Governor Walker's office or the governor himself may have known about this. What came out this morning?
Yes, that's right. So what's clear is what came out this morning is that that the governor knew about complaints at Lincoln Hills in 2014. So for over a year has had some word on this. And to be honest, I think it's sort of an open secret among journalists that there have been people who current or former employees in the system who have raised concerns that this, we know that this John Doe investigation that led to the latest Lincoln Hills allegations and what's become public about that juvenile facility, that investigation itself has been going on for over a year. So it's looking bad in the sense that there seem to be a lot of arrows that were pointing to conditions not being what they should be and not being safe in that facility.
We're talking to Robert Menser right now, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media, getting our state news roundup right now. And we're going to wind up here with a story that a state lawmaker has introduced a bill that would affect a Native American effigy or burial mounds in Wisconsin. What would these changes be?
So I found this a fascinating story reported by Jeff Glaze in the Wisconsin State Journal, and it reflects there's long been this battle over a particular site of Native American effigy mounds in Blooming Grove in Dane County, and there is a giant, sort of, you know, 50-acre limestone quarry there. And within this quarry, there are a couple of specific acres where there's a burial mound is protected by the Wisconsin Historical Society, and they're not allowed to dig there. The companies say that the what they could get in that quarry is worth about $10 to $12 million, $10 to $15 million, and so they want to dig it up. So they say there's not even any evidence that there actually are human remains there. And meanwhile, the Ho-Chunk Nation and the Historical Society say that they've surveyed this, and they say that it's part of this larger burial site called the Ward Mound Group. I found this very, very interesting. So the bill would create this weird catch-22. It would allow them to dig up the site to verify that there are not human remains there. So it's this weird thing. If you dig up the site and you find that there are human remains, then you wouldn't be allowed to dig it up. But of course, you've already dug it up. If there aren't human remains there, then you would be allowed to dig it up, but you can't know that until you've dug it up.
Right. So how has the Ho-Chunk Nation responded to this?
It is hard to determine this. So the Wisconsin Historical Society used radar, they used magnetometry, and they surveyed this site and identified a bunch of these sites in the state. It finally was certified in 1990, but there had been mining going on in this particular site and in the area since 1962, and there were no legal protections at all in place until 1986. So they've said that there's no evidence that there's the miners have said there's no evidence of burials there. The Historical Society and the Ho-Chunk Nation say that they have oral traditions, they have history, and there's evidence in the area. It is genuinely hard to prove whether this specific sort of 3-acre site has burial mounds, but we know for sure that there's burial mounds in that area, and it just feels like it's this weird sort of logically inconsistent thing where you have to dig it up to figure out whether you need to protect it.
And we'll be talking more about that on Central Time coming up next Wednesday, so you can stay tuned for that. Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
That was Robert Menser, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. He joined us for our Wisconsin News Roundup this week. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
The statistics on childhood sexual abuse are alarming. Research conducted by the Centers for Disease Control estimates that approximately 1 in 6 boys and 1 in 4 girls are sexually abused before the age of 18.
Our next guest shared his experiences coming out as gay in 1970s Wisconsin in his memoir, My Queer Life. In his second memoir, Empty Playground, A Survivor's Story, Callan Hardy shares his recovery from childhood sexual abuse. Callan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So you grew up in the small town of Schulzburg, Wisconsin, in the Driftless region, and your family had really deep roots there. Tell us about your early childhood.
My family did have really deep roots there. They settled in 1827, which was well before Wisconsin statehood. So I grew up in this town that our family was part of that history. Very small town, Irish Catholic. My family was Irish Catholic. Half the town was Methodist. Half the town was Catholic. There were a couple other little things in there. So very strict Roman Catholic upbringing with my mother. My father had died when I was 2 years old. So I was the only child in my class growing up in a single-parent household at that time, which is very uncommon back then, but not so much now.
And you talk about the town having all these protected buildings. It's a very idyllic kind of idealized Wisconsin American setting. But for you, around the age of 9 or 10, that all really changed.
It did. It is a very beautiful town. There's 50 buildings on the Register of Historic Sites, the National Register. But one of the things that I mentioned in the book is sometimes behind those buildings, behind those curtains, you don't know what's going on. And that it's not just in Schulzburg. That's in cities all across the country. One in six boys and 1 in 4 girls, as mm-hmm. Veronica mentioned, are being abused. So when I was 9, I was touched. When I was 10, some more serious things started happening. And that lasted all the way till I was 17 and a half years old.
And you decided very consciously in this book to talk specifically about who had abused you and to be precise in your descriptions of the abuse. Why was that important to you?
I think it's easy for people to disassociate. It's easy to look at somebody who's in their 50s and not see the child who was hurt. Mm-hmm. So whenever I do speaking engagements, I always show a photograph of what I was looked like when I was 10, so that people understand mm-hmm. that. I think it's also easy to say, you know, you're an adult, get over it. But when people hear the description of what really happened, I think they understand that's not something you get over with real easily. So I thought it was important to not incorporate all the raw mm-hmm. stuff, but some detail about what really happened so that would be understood, because mm-hmm. I think it's awfully easy to think the least possible harmful thing.
To sanitize it in your own mind.
Yes. And I think as a country, as a state, as a city, wherever we happen to be, we have a big problem with this. And I think we really, really need to talk about it. And we need to talk about it openly and honestly, or it's never going to end.
So your abuser was your older brother, Kevin, and he was enough older than you that you were still really a child, and he was more moving into his early and mid teen years and then into his 20s by the time the abuse ended. So here's your older brother who you admired and loved, and then the abuse started and continued. How did you try to reconcile that in your child mind?
I didn't know how to. You have, you know, it's almost Christmas time. You have family celebrations. You have birthdays, Christmases, where the whole family's together and loving each other. And yet, in the background, in my mind, those things were happening, and I was remembering them. So it was hard, and you never knew when it might happen again. When that person is living in your household, that makes it incredibly difficult, because mom goes to the grocery store or goes to church, and you're there alone. Something might happen. It might not. You never knew. So, and the trust issue is huge when it's a family member. One of the reasons I felt it was important to name that relationship in the book was because I think there's this notion out there that there's creepy guys in vans or hanging around school grounds who are going to kidnap your child. And that is such a small percentage of what happens. The vast majority of the time is a close family member, a trusted adult, a neighbor, friend, somebody the child knows and really trusts, and the family knows and really trusts. And oftentimes when it's revealed, families or other people don't believe it even happened. They refuse to believe the child.
We're talking with Callan Hardy about his most recent memoir, Empty Playground, A Survivor's Story. And Callan, you did what we teach our children to do in a situation like that. You told someone about what was happening, and what was the result?
That's a very hard memory still. I wrote a play a few years ago about this as well, called Invisible Boy. But I told, the first time something happened, I tried to tell my mother that I was touched down there. Mm-hmm. And she looked at me and she said, "Oh, you shouldn't let him do that to you." So that put the onus on me. I took that in. I took the blame. I let him do that, is what I felt. So then when something more serious happened, I did not go back to her. And being a good Catholic boy, I should have gone to confession if I had done something wrong, but I couldn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. That's not something I could have told the priest, or mm-hmm. And if I told my mother and she didn't know how to deal with it, who else was I going to tell?
But in that moment also, you saw something in your mother's eyes.
I did.
That made you think that perhaps this was an experience that she had had herself.
She went away. I think she dissociated at that moment. I was looking at her and she was somewhere else. And at 10 years old or 9, I'm not sure exactly what old age I was when that happened, I sort of knew in my heart that something had happened to her when she was younger.
Is that something that you were ever able to revisit with her?
I asked her about it. She said, "I don't know. I don't think so." I think that she may have blocked it out if something did happen. And now she's 90 years old and has dementia, so I can't talk to her about things like that at all.
Your book is called Empty Playground, A Survivor's Story. What does the empty playground represent for you?
That comes from, there was a moment when I was in high school, in the school cafeteria in Shelbury High School, looks out to the playground, and it was wintertime. There was nobody on the playground, snow all over the place, swings blowing in the wind a little bit. And in my entire life, I've always thought of things symbolically, and I looked at that, and it represented to me that childhood that I had lost when I was younger. I wrote that into a poem several years later with the line, "There's nothing more tragic than a deserted playground." So I decided to use that as the title of the book, but also the subtitle is A Survivor Story. I'm a survivor. I'm not a victim, and I'm doing everything I can to make sure there are no more victims.
And so being abused by a male made your process of accepting and embracing being a gay man that much more complicated. Can you share a little bit of how you were able to finally tease out that abuse in your childhood and your sexuality as an adult?
Yeah, I think being abused by a man, whether you're gay or straight, brings up a lot of questions about sexuality. There's many a straight man who was abused by a man who question their sexuality even though they're very straight, because it makes you wonder, did I do something to invite this? I've had those thoughts as well, but as I was coming out, I also realized that I had boy crushes before that ever started happening. I remembered a seriously a crush that I had in second grade on another boy, and that was several years before anything like that had ever happened. So little by little, in piecing those bits together, I realized that my sexuality had nothing to do with that abuse, and I didn't invite it because I was gay. I didn't become gay because of it. And a lot of people misunderstand that. I think it's a very important thing for people to know that those are two absolutely separate things. One doesn't cause the other, or vice versa.
So you said that for you it's really important to identify, instead of being a victim, as being a survivor. Is there a point that you feel like you made that transition yourself, or was it a really, I know it was a long process coming to terms with the abuse and even remembering a lot of the abuse, but is there a point where you felt, I'm a survivor, I have survived this?
Yeah, I think after I survived my heart attack, after the heart attack is when I wrote the play about it. It's when I decided I needed to face this and deal with it, and also share that story so that others might be able to deal with their stories as well. So that was probably about only 5 years ago, so already into my 50s. A lot of people take decades to be able to deal with this kind of thing.
And I want to make sure people know your play, Invisible Boy, which is a lot of this same material that you draw on for your memoir, Empty Playground, is actually available on YouTube.
On Vimeo.com.
Vimeo.
Yep.
So they can just search
Invisible Boy or my name, Callan Hardy, and they can find that.
Well, Callan, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Wisconsin author and playwright Callan Hardy. His new memoir is called Empty Playground, A Survivor's Story.
I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson, in for Rob Ferret.
The recent shootings in San Bernardino and Paris and suspected hate crimes targeting mosques in retaliation have highlighted the tensions that can exist between people of different religions.
But our next guests say conflict is not inevitable between people of different belief systems, and they're making the case for more productive and positive relationships. They say we can start by boosting our interfaith literacy and learning from one another about our different faiths.
Our guests are both part of the group Interfaith Youth Core. Carr Harkrader is with us. Carr, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
And Prana Abbey joins us as well. Prana, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us.
Well, to start off, Carr, what do we mean by the term interfaith literacy?
Well, that's a really good question. And I first want to say it's a little bit different than what you would think of as religious literacy. I think with basic religious literacy, we're thinking of some facts and figures about different religions or non-religious worldviews out there. So, for instance, how many Muslims there are in the world, or what are the core beliefs of Christianity. With interfaith literacy, we're really talking about having knowledge of other religious and non-religious backgrounds so that you can positively work with others, right? So positively do social action with other groups of people who have a different religious worldview than yourself.
Is it about looking for that common ground?
Well, right. So that's a key element of it. Here at Interfaith Youth Core, that's a main part of our mission, is working with college students, with people across higher education, to promote common ground and to promote really common service, right? So working together with people who come from many different backgrounds and yet have a common goal.
And Priya, let's bring you in on this. Why is it important for people to understand each other's belief systems instead of just being friendly to each other and in general kind? Why do they need to have that understanding?
Well, I think it impacts so much of what we do and the ways that we're interacting with each other. So I think, you know, I work on our alumni relations team. I'm working with young adults who are a few years into the workforce. And we hear so often ways that having that appreciative knowledge, knowing things about the ways that other people see the world and the way that they practice makes a difference in the workplace even. So that's just one example, being able to understand why you might not want to have a Friday afternoon meeting because your Jewish colleagues may not be able to attend or your Muslim colleagues may not be able to attend makes a better work environment and a better relationship between colleagues.
So the workplace is one example. Priya, what are some other arenas where this comes into play?
I think it comes into play definitely in the school environment. It definitely impacts the way that children are able to learn. So, for example, I came from a Hindu family, and being in a school environment in the suburbs of New York where nobody knew what Hinduism was and all of my classmates were Christian, was really difficult for me to be able to take off days for important holidays that my family wanted to celebrate, or to be able to eat the food, or to offer any information to my classmates or even my teachers about the ways that I wanted to celebrate who I was very hard, where it was very easy for my classmates. And it was difficult for me as a young child to understand why they got to have that and I couldn't.
And Carr, are there right ways and wrong ways to start learning about different people's religious belief systems, or is any place a good place to start?
Well, we like to focus on three main areas, which is, one, start trying to cultivate your appreciative knowledge of different traditions that are out there. So that can be done in conventional ways, right, like being in a religious studies class, say, if you're in college, or reading a book about a different religion. But we also talk about working with people, working with individuals who are different than you, and learning, kind of like what Prana was saying in an elementary school example, learning from your peers around you, and then as you get older, working with them in different service situations. That's a big component of what we talk about. So I would say the one piece is that appreciative knowledge. The second one there is identifying values of commonality, right? And so we often talk about service, for instance. The value of service is something that many different religious and non-religious traditions share and that you can organize events around. And then that third piece is understanding interfaith history, right? So having some idea of events or people or concepts in the American past that influences today to support, understand, and appreciate one another.
So Priya, what do you do if along the way you're working with a group of people on developing this interfaith literacy, mm-hmm. and a person of one faith encounters something that is maybe something that they don't believe, maybe it's in direct contradiction of what they've been taught growing up in their faith? How do you handle those moments?
Sure. Well, I think a big misconception about interfaith cooperation and working with people of other faiths is that we should all end up with this idea that, oh, we all believe the same thing, where that definitely isn't true. And for some of us, that might be something that we believe or hope to believe. And for some of us, that's something that definitely is antithetical to what we believe, in direct opposition to what it is that we hold dear. And so I think that's very important to recognize, is that interfaith cooperation is not about ending up in this space where we all believe the same thing, but rather having respect for folks who do believe different things and being able to recognize the value of some of the different things that people believe that might be different from you, why it's something that they hold dear and why it makes them a person that you appreciate and want to be around.
And I'll jump in there just briefly to say, to add on to what Prana said, is that the reason, I often tell students that we're working with this, the reason why interfaith cooperation is important is not that we're all the same or not that we all agree, but because we all are different. And that's the reason why we need to work together on important issues in our culture and our society.
Absolutely.
We're talking with Carr Harkrader and Prana Abbey with the Interfaith Youth Corps, and they're making the case that we should boost our knowledge about different belief systems. And we want to know, Carr, could you tell us a little bit about how you do this? Do you do it individually? Do you do it in groups? How does that actual work get done?
Oh, that's a really good question. So Interfaith Youth Corps works with college students and staff and faculty at different universities across the country, right? And so it can look like, you know, depending from campus to campus, it can look like a lot of different things. One thing that we've actually seen that has been really successful is what we call speed faithing, and it's a chance for young people to articulate a little bit about their background, but then also why their background motivates them to work with other people. people. And these are quick little rounds of, it can be from 5 to 10 to 15 minutes each, where people can come, hear from someone who is from a particular background, get a piece of knowledge about that background, but more importantly, understand why that person, whether they're Jewish or Christian or Muslim or Hindu or Jain, why they want to work with others. So that's something that I've seen really be successful at different colleges across the country.
So what kinds of things might people share?
Well, let me think. One of the things that I've seen, for instance, Utah State University out in Logan, Utah, they recently put on a speed faithing event, and there was one student that talked about her shaman background, right? So she practiced shamanism. And as you might guess, out in Utah, a majority of the students that go to that campus were LDS, or Mormon, as we commonly call it. And she was able to share a piece of her background that normally a lot of those students wouldn't have been able to hear, right? So something very different than their background. But she connected it to the reason why she's so involved in so many service organizations on her campus was because of her belief, in certain shamanistic practices. So it was really an interesting, I think, connection of her personal story and, right, her personal beliefs with a belief that a lot of those LDS students shared, which is serving the community, serving your campus, and supporting your family.
And Prina, the idea here is partially that as these groups of people who've learned about each other and the ways that they're different and their common ground, is that they go out into the world and they interact in as like little seeds of ambassadors of goodwill and and understanding. Have you seen that kind of thing happen in the people that you've worked with?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned, I work with our alumni. So some of the students that we're working with, when they go out into the workforce, I get to see all of the amazing things that we're doing. And they really are across the board. So as you might guess, some of them go into ministry and are working as pastors and rabbis and imams and college chaplains. And they're, you know, involved in this work in more obvious ways. But we have plenty of students who choose to go into healthcare and become doctors and nurses and careers along those lines, and we see them lifting up this value of how important it is to understand what's going on with folks of other traditions and the way that might impact their healthcare. So, for example, the understanding that a religious community is often more than just religion and that it can be really impactful in healthcare interventions. So we have an alum here in Chicago who has been working with churches on the south and west sides of Chicago to do interventions around diabetes prevention. And that's because he has an understanding of what the religious community offers to the folks who are a part of it.
We're talking with Carr Harkrader and Prina Abbey right now with the Interfaith Youth Corps, and they're telling us about how we can boost our knowledge about different belief systems. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We continue our conversation about interfaith literacy and the effort to build understanding between people from different faiths and belief systems. Our guests are Prina Abbey and Carr Hardraker from Interfaith Youth Corps.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is there an interfaith group in your community? Have you been part of a local public service effort that brought people together of different faiths? And do you wish you knew more about another religion or that people knew more about yours, maybe? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We have a link to an interfaith literacy quiz posted there, too, that you can take a swing at. And Prina, we're going to go back to you right now. Now, we were talking earlier about people coming together, going out into the world, but what about the place we're in right now, not just in this country, but in other places in the world, where there are times of mistrust and fear sometimes when we approach the prospect of another belief system. Mm-hmm. And not everyone is going to enter into this sort of learning opportunity willingly. So how do you approach situations like that?
Yeah, I think it's really difficult, especially when you have appreciation for a tradition like Islam and for your Muslim neighbors, and you're seeing how folks around you maybe don't. And I think that this is actually a time where it's important for us to be empowered to support our our Muslim American neighbors and friends and colleagues. And, you know, there have been lots of memes going around on Facebook and social media of lists of ways that the average person can do something when it feels like there really isn't a lot to do, and ranging from, you know, as simple as if you see a woman in a hijab on the train, smile at her, give her a little nod, and just, you know, that extra sense of security that, you know, you have an understanding that, you know, she is not ISIS or she is not extremism embodied here in our country and that she's an American just like us.
And how would you answer that question, Carr?
Well, it's interesting because actually as we were waiting to come back on air after the break, I heard on your news feed about the event down in Virginia with the school system where some parents got upset about their students writing in Arabic. And it was, you know, I don't know if you can tell from my accent, but I'm from the South, and so I'm a little bit familiar with that area. And ironically, just a few miles down the road from that county, Augusta County, is Charlottesville, Virginia, where Thomas Jefferson grave is. And on that grave, he has three things, which is one, that he was the author of the Declaration of Independence. The second one is that he was the founder of the University of Virginia. And the third one is that he helped write and draft the Statute for Virginia on Religious Freedom. And I think it's facts like that, you know, that statue in Virginia, which later influenced the U.S. Constitution and the religious freedom and diversity that we have in America today, that fact is just as important to know as what's happening one county over today. And I think if more people knew about and knew information about the religious diversity in our country and the religious tolerance that we've traditionally had, I think that will make a big difference so that events like what's happening in Virginia now will be less common.
Do you think when people have these knowledge gaps, when they're ignorant about the other people around them and what they might believe, that leads more easily to fear?
Well, right, it can lead to a lot of things, right? I mean, to some people, it'll be a challenge to learn more, right? And to some people, it might lead to fear. But I think we often talk about how having some kind of appreciative knowledge about another group will build stronger and more positive relationships with other people, right? And if you're in a relationship, and by that I mean either a friendship or a close coworker or maybe a close classmate, then you're less likely to fear that group as a whole, right? And Pew, which is, you know, a national research site, has done a lot of good polling on this, where it shows you are, I think they said, three times more likely to have positive feelings towards all Muslims if you have one Muslim friend. And I think that goes across the board for a lot of different religious and non-religious worldviews. So I think you're right that fear is one challenge that you have when you might lack some knowledge of other groups, but that can be easily remedied by hopefully cultivating some of this interfaith literacy that we're talking about today.
And Prina, we've been talking some about appreciative knowledge. Can you give us some concrete examples of what that might look like?
Sure. I think one form of appreciative knowledge is an understanding of, you know, what are some of the things that your friends and neighbors believe. So, for example, in Islam, a practice on Eid, which is one of their major holidays, one of the Eids that is celebrated, there's often sacrifice of an animal, but it's not just left, then that meat is often used to feed folks around you. And oftentimes in the U.S., that meat is shared with families in need. Folks might donate it to a local shelter or other place where that meat can be used, or they might donate overseas to a community that's more in need than their own community. And I think that's a really great thing to know, that this is a value that your friends and neighbors hold. And I think that's something that not to say that we believe the same thing, but I think that a lot of us could find a similar sense in what we believe in our own minds.
We're talking about interfaith literacy right now with Carr Hartgrader, Campus Engagement Associate for Interfaith Youth Corps, and also talking with Prina Abbey, Alumni Relations Associate at Interfaith Youth Corps as well. And Carr, I want to ask you, do people ever have a fear that if they learn about another religion, that somehow they're maybe betraying their own faith?
Well, you know, I think that well might be the case for some people. I think for the overwhelming majority of people in the United States today, though, there's a realization that we not only, you know, not only is it nice to know something about a different religion or non-religious worldview, but it's needed, right? You can't, as Prina was mentioning earlier, there's very few jobs that you can hold nowadays without interacting with somebody from a different religious worldview than you. There's very few places you can live without some type of religious diversity. And so whatever, whether there's a hang up there or not, I think, one, I can reassure people you shouldn't be fearful of that at all. But two, I would say, you know, embrace it. And actually, a lot of the students that we have worked with have said that they've been strengthened in their own faith when learning about others, right? Because in a way, it almost forces you to think about, okay, well, what do I believe then? So I think in many cases, it's the exact opposite.
And Prina, what if people want to get involved in this kind of thing, but they don't live somewhere, for instance, where there is an interfaith group? What can they do?
No, I think that that's a really great question because for so many of us, there isn't one, right? I think there are a lot of ways. One is simply to reach out to your friends and neighbors, right? Religion is something that's on that list of things you should never talk about. And, you know, I think especially at a time like now, it shouldn't be. This is a great time to share, you know, what it is that you and your family are experiencing or celebrating or struggling with at this time of year. And I think that there are plenty of experiential things that you can do as well. Most religious communities would be absolutely thrilled for someone of a different religious or non-religious background to come and visit and to experience what their service might be like, not to say that you're practicing with them, but to experience and to see and to learn you know, what it is that happens in the mosque down the street or at the synagogue down the street or the temple. And, you know, there are lots of resources out there, and if you contact these houses of worship, they are more likely than not absolutely thrilled to welcome you.
And let me also put in a shameless plug. If you are listening somewhere and want to know more about interfaith literacy, you can go to ifyc.org/podcast, and we have a whole podcast that we host on interfaith literacy each month.
And Kara, I want to follow up on something Preya said about reaching out to people and talking about one of those do not talk about subjects, which is religion. How do you do that? I mean, it sounds like one of those things that we can talk about, but how do you say, tell me about your religion? I mean, it's not something you start with as at the very top of I'm getting to know you question. How do you get there?
Right. Well, you're right that it's not a very good pickup line, right? So I wouldn't start with that, you know, if you're just meeting someone for the first time. But one way to think about it is with, like Prana was saying, being intentional about reaching out to local community groups, whether they're houses of worship, whether they're just diverse community or civic groups in your area. I think those are also places that are wonderful, wonderful grounds for finding that kind of that social capital, right, of many diverse people coming together. Another thing is to be intentional in how you either plan events or the type of event that you're planning. So that speed faithing that I mentioned earlier is we found a very effective way of kind of breaking that ice, right, that awkward tension that you mentioned, and saying, you know what, this is going to be a space where we talk about this. People shouldn't feel awkward. I'm going to share some knowledge from my own tradition, and then take a few questions. And actually, that's I can't say enough how popular that is with a lot of the people we work with, because it does break that ice, it breaks that tension. And so I would just say being intentional, being proactive, definitely, you know, don't think of one individual, right, as a representation, anybody, of any, you know, religion. So I wouldn't corner anybody in the store or at the grocery store or wherever. But just be intentional, be thoughtful, and I think you can learn a lot that way.
Kara, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you all for having us.
And Prina, thank you to you too.
Thank you both.
That was Kara Harkrader and Prina Abbey. They're both with the Interfaith Youth Corps, and we're talking about about interfaith literacy with them. And you can find a link to an interfaith literacy quiz on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.